Today is Wednesday, May 27th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 34 to 37 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's fourth drone strike on a Russian-guided missile frigate worth nearly $500 million, the advancing U.S.-Iran ceasefire framework that could unfreeze up to $100 billion in Iranian assets, and Australia's new national defense strategy, the first to name China explicitly as the country's core strategic threat. Let's begin on the Black Sea. On the night of May 23rd, Ukrainian drone units conducted strikes on Novorossiysk naval base in Russia's Krasnodar region. The operation targeted two Russian naval vessels, and its details were published online, including video footage, by Major Robert Magyar Bravdy, identified by the military show as one of the best-known commanders of Ukraine's unmanned systems forces. The primary target was the Admiral Essen, an Admiral Grigorovich-class guided missile frigate, designated a Project 11-356 Romeo vessel. According to the military show's cited reporting, the ship is valued at an estimated $450 to $500 million. To put that in physical terms, the Admiral Essen displaces 4,000 tons at full load, stretches just over 409 feet in length, carries up to 200 crew members, and is capable of reaching speeds of up to 30 knots. Its armament includes 8 vertical launch system cells, capable of firing Kaliber, Onyx, or Tsarkhan cruise missiles, an additional 24 vertical launch system cells for surface-to-air missiles, a 100mm naval gun, 2 AK-630 rotary cannons, torpedo launchers, and an anti-submarine rocket launcher. According to Brovdy's account, at least one drone struck the side of the Admiral Essen directly, with at least 3 additional unmanned aerial vehicles also colliding with the frigate. The ship attempted to engage the drones with its onboard defenses and failed to bring them down. That detail alone is worth pausing on. A vessel of this size and armament, specifically designed to detect and defeat incoming threats, was unable to neutralize a wave of comparatively inexpensive drone munitions. It speaks to both the maturity of Ukraine's drone program and the asymmetric economics at the heart of this campaign. A second vessel was also struck that night, an unnamed Project 1239 Bora-class hoverborne guided missile corvette, one of only 2 such vessels ever built. That ship displaces just over 1,000 tons, measures 215 feet in length, and has a peak speed of 55 knots, making it one of the fastest warships in the Russian fleet. It too absorbed multiple drone impacts, per the same source. What makes the May 23rd attack particularly significant in a strategic context is what it represents sequentially. This was the fourth recorded strike on the Admiral Essen. The first came in 2022, delivered by a Neptune cruise missile. The second occurred on March 2, 2026, targeting the ship's superstructure and producing a fire that burned for approximately 18 hours, damaging the grenade launchers, the TK-25 electronic warfare complex, and multiple radar systems. The third strike followed on April 6, 2026, with satellite imagery showing fresh hits to the frigate's bow section near its naval gun. Open-source intelligence analysts assessed at the time that the strike may have degraded the ship's mobility. Building on that trajectory, the May 23rd attack constitutes the fourth blow against the same high-value target in roughly 3.5 years, a pattern that suggests not opportunism, but deliberate campaign design. Ukraine appears to be pursuing a strategy of incremental attrition against a $500 million asset, using munitions that cost a fraction of that value per unit. The ship has not been destroyed, but each strike compounds the maintenance burden, the crew risk, the operational degradation, and the reputational signal to the Russian fleet. 3 Ukrainian units participated in the May 23rd operation, the 9th Kairos Battalion, the 412th Nemesis Brigade, and the 414th Unmanned Strike Aviation Brigade, per Brovdy. No Russian government confirmation, denial, or casualty figures appeared in the cited transcripts. The Novorossiysk strikes were not the only targets that night. Brovdy also reported that May 23rd drone operations struck an OSA surface-to-air missile system in the Donetsk region, valued at approximately $10 million. Separately, drone strikes hit a rear base and logistics hub of Russia's 6th Air and Air Defense Forces Army in Ravenki, in the Luhansk region, a drone command post in the Kherson region, fuel tankers and armored vehicles in the Zaporizhia region, and, notably, two oil terminals in Novorossiysk itself. Those two terminals are the Sheskharis terminal and the Grushova terminal. The Grushova terminal is described by the military show as the largest petroleum storage facility in the Caucasus region, with a stated capacity of up to 1.2 million tons of fuel. Striking energy infrastructure alongside naval assets in the same port city on the same night reflects a coordinated, multi-objective operation rather than a series of opportunistic strikes. Moving now to the broader battlefield picture inside Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov conveyed to U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio that Russian forces are beginning what he described as systematic strikes against decision-making centers in Kyiv and Ukrainian military compounds. Russian military sources separately threatened to, in their words, completely obliterate the Ukrainian capital. These statements were reported by Professor Scott Lucas of University College Dublin's Clinton Institute, speaking in a transcript cited by Warren Politics 24. A weekend attack involving approximately 90 missiles and 600 drones struck targets across Ukraine, with a majority directed at Kyiv. Four people were killed and more than 100 were injured, with most casualties in the capital, per the same source. The Jason J. Smart transcript, reporting on a May 24th attack of identical scale, 90 missiles and 600 drones, stated that Ukrainian forces intercepted 55 missiles and 549 drones, which the transcript characterized as a 91% drone intercept rate. No named Ukrainian or international body was cited as the source for those specific figures. Following these strikes, Russia warned embassies to evacuate personnel from Kyiv. A series of G7 country embassies and the European Union's ambassador declined to leave. The EU ambassador stated publicly that the mission would remain alongside Ukraine, a symbolic act of institutional solidarity with real diplomatic weight. A disputed incident preceded the escalation. Ukrainian drone strikes hit a building in Russian-occupied Donetsk. Russian sources described the target as a college dormitory, with 21 people aged approximately 18 to 23 reported killed. Ukraine said it was targeting a drone command headquarters called Rubicon. The two accounts remain unreconciled, and that ambiguity sits at the center of the information war that runs parallel to the physical one. The Financial Times, credited specifically to reporter Christopher Miller, and Bloomberg separately reported, per Professor Lucas, that President Putin seeks to end the war on Russian terms, including capture of the entirety of the Donbas by year's end. Lucas assessed that Putin has reportedly given up on Trump assisting him in that goal, though he attributed that view to his own analysis rather than named sourcing. The Institute for the Study of War, cited by the Jason J. Smart transcript, assessed that Ukraine has seized the initiative on the battlefield. To understand what that means in concrete terms, consider the scale of Russian advances through May 24th. Russia gained only 35 kilometers, approximately 14 miles, along the approximately 1,200-kilometer active front line. The transcript calculated that as roughly 29 meters of depth on average across the entire line of contact. That is a notably small return for the scale of forces Russia is deploying. One settlement, Mala Tokmachka, has resisted Russian capture for over 1,500 days. A March estimate cited in the same transcript put Russian casualties in that area at 254 per square kilometer, calculated as more than 8,900 casualties for that single village. Those numbers, if accurate, illustrate the cost Russia is absorbing for extremely limited territorial gain. On the Ukrainian offensive side, President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed on May 21st that the SBU Special Operations Center Alpha conducted a drone strike on a Russian FSB headquarters near Hennichesk in the partially occupied Kherson region. According to the military show, the facility comprised 9 buildings repurposed from a hotel or resort complex on the Arabat Spit. Zelensky stated directly, The headquarters of the Russian FSB officers were hit, and an anti-aircraft complex Panzer S-1 was destroyed in our temporarily occupied territory. Thanks to this operation alone, the Russians suffered losses of about 100 occupiers killed and wounded. The destroyed Panzer S-1 system is valued at up to $20 million per unit per the military show. NASA's FIRM Satellite Monitoring Service, a system that tracks thermal signatures globally, detected elevated heat signatures at the site on May 17th, the reported date of the strike, per the same cited reporting. In a separate operation on May 19th, Bravdi stated that drone pilots struck a training and production facility of the 78th Sever-Akhmat Motorized Special Purpose Regiment in Snizhny, occupied Donetsk. 11 attack drones, each armed with 100-kilogram warheads, were used in an operation named Snow for Akhmat. The targeted compound measured approximately 2,484 square meters. Bravdi stated an estimated 65 Russian Special Forces cadets were killed, along with the head of the center. These figures were not independently confirmed. Ukraine's unmanned systems forces stated that between May 1st and May 21st, they eliminated 20 Russian air defense systems, a figure that, if sustained, would represent a significant erosion of Russia's layered defensive architecture. The cumulative pressure on Russian logistics is generating commentary even within pro-war Russian circles. Military blogger Maxim Kalashnikov wrote that the land route to Crimea increasingly resembles roads in Afghanistan in the 1980s, with the remains of destroyed vehicles scattered along the sides of the road. A blogger identified as Romanov noted the absence of sky monitoring posts along the route and stated that the number and frequency of such attacks will soon increase. On internal Russian dynamics, the Jason J. Smart transcript reported that Igor Volo, identified as a former vice president of Gazprombank, has defected to Ukraine and is associated with an organization called Black Spark, described as a resistance movement conducting sabotage operations within Russia, focused on the oil and gas sector. The transcript stated that Russia is losing approximately $159 million daily in oil and gas revenue on a year-over-year basis, and that Russian internet shutdowns are costing companies between $12.5 million and $25 million per day, roughly $750 million per month. No named external source was cited for either figure. President Putin signed a law offering debt cancellation of between $100,000 and $140,000 to military personnel signing contracts of at least 1 year, an amount the transcript described as equivalent to 9 to 13 years of a Russian teacher's salary. And the United Nations conservatively estimates civilian deaths from Russia's full-scale invasion at more than 15,000, a figure that does not include undocumented deaths, such as those during the 2022 siege of Mariupol, per Professor Lucas. Turning now to the Gulf and the evolving state of U.S.-Iran negotiations. The United States and Iran are engaged in talks over a potential agreement to extend an existing ceasefire, according to reporting cited by Visualpolitik EN. White House leaks described proposed terms that would extend the ceasefire by 60 days. Unfreeze Iranian funds potentially reaching up to $100 billion, and authorize Iran to sell its oil on international markets. In exchange, Iran would partially reopen the Strait of Hormuz and begin negotiations on its nuclear program. President Trump posted to Truth Social following phone calls with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Pakistan, Turkey, Egypt, Jordan, and Bahrain, 8 countries in total, that an agreement has largely been negotiated subject to finalization between the United States of America, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and various other countries. Trump separately stated that enriched uranium and nuclear material would, in his words, either be immediately turned over to the United States to be brought home and destroyed, or preferably in conjunction and coordination with the Islamic Republic of Iran, destroyed in a place or at another acceptable location, with Atomic Energy Commission oversight. He also stated he had spoken with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and that final aspects and details of the deal are currently being discussed and will be announced shortly. Secretary of State Rubio described remaining obstacles as wording issues and said a deal could be finalized within a few days, per Professor Lucas. However, the situation is more complicated than those characterizations suggest. U.S. airstrikes against Iran were conducted overnight, and Iran stated it has the right to retaliate, per the same source. The gap between diplomatic framing and ongoing military action is significant. Professor Lucas described the emerging framework in more specific terms. On the Iranian side, the arrangement would involve lifting American sanctions, reparations for war damages, and a long-term ceasefire of at minimum 60 days, after which Iran said it would be prepared to discuss its nuclear program. Iran is seeking the unfreezing of approximately $24 billion of its assets held abroad, with immediate discussions focused on either a loan or unfreezing of $12 billion, with Qatar playing a role in those discussions. Lucas noted that approximately $100 billion in Iranian assets are held by other countries in total, a figure that contextualizes why unfreezing even a fraction of those holdings represents significant economic leverage for Tehran. Iran's position, per Visualpolitik.en, is that the time has not come to negotiate away its nuclear program. On the Strait of Hormuz, Iran's stance is that while the strait may be open to navigation, it would remain under the control of an authority established by the Revolutionary Guard. Iran's foreign minister stated that toll collection is not currently planned, but Visualpolitik.en noted that this statement carries limited weight absent explicit endorsement from the Revolutionary Guard itself. Not everyone is aligned with the emerging framework. Israel communicated that the agreement in its current form is unacceptable, per Visualpolitik.en. Republican lawmakers also raised public objections. Trump's team called it absurd to suggest the president would agree to a deal leaving Iran in a stronger nuclear position. And Trump himself posted that expansion of the Abraham Accords was a mandatory requirement for any deal, naming 8 countries under discussion, a condition that significantly expands the diplomatic scope of what would need to be negotiated. The Strait of Hormuz remains closed as of the time of this reporting, creating strain across supply chains involving oil, gas, fuels, helium, sulfuric acid, and nitrogen fertilizers, per Visualpolitik.en. J.P. Morgan, cited in the same transcript, warned that absent restoration of energy supply, international reserves would face severe strain beginning in June and near operational collapse beginning in September. That is a tight timeline for negotiations that still have, in Rubio's own characterization, unresolved wording issues. Trump stated in late April that Iran had only days before its oil system would collapse, a forecast that analysts assessed as premature, per Visualpolitik.en. The underlying economic reality is more nuanced. In 2015, following an agreement with the Obama administration that eased sanctions, Iran's GDP increased by 7.5%. Iranian officials are reportedly factoring that precedent into their current negotiating posture, calculating that sanctions relief, if secured, could deliver significant economic dividends. The military campaign, which Visualpolitik.en described as Operation Epic Fury, destroyed thousands of targets and killed at least 53 high-ranking Iranian officials. Virtually all of those officials have since been replaced by figures described as more radical, a dynamic that raises the question of whether targeted strikes on leadership actually produced the intended deterrent effect, or whether they accelerated consolidation of power by hardline elements. The Revolutionary Guard has since consolidated control over the military chain of command, military industry, strategic decision-making, and security forces, per Visualpolitik.en. A U.S.-based human rights organization focused on Iran, cited in the Visualpolitik.en transcript, reported that more than 600 people have been executed in Iran since the beginning of the year. A Tomahawk missile strike was reported to have hit a school, resulting in the deaths of more than 150 girls, per the same source. These are the human dimensions of a conflict whose diplomatic resolution is still being negotiated in real time. The U.S. Senate passed a War Powers Resolution requiring congressional consultation before continuation of the conflict, though the lower chamber had not yet approved it as of the time of the interview, per Lucas. Secretary of State Rubio also stated that Ukraine-Russia talks are not progressing, and that the United States will not continue to broker those negotiations, a statement that illustrates just how severely Washington's bandwidth for simultaneous conflict mediation is being tested. From the Gulf, we move to a domain that spans every theater simultaneously, space. A public panel discussion hosted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies addressed the militarization of space, with participants Heather Williams, director of the CSIS Project on Nuclear Issues, Kerry Bingen, director of the CSIS Aerospace Security Project, and Tom Carrico, director of the CSIS Missile Defense Project. The framing of the conversation was set by a statement from U.S. Space Command Commander General Stephen Whiting, who was quoted as saying that the U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps have over 35 years become optimized around access to space capabilities and, in his words, do not have the force structure to fight the way we used to fight without space. Former Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Chris Grady was cited by Bingen as having described space as the critical domain because it enables all terrestrial advantage. This is not abstract doctrine. Two named operations were cited as instances in which space was fully integrated into military planning and execution. Operation Absolute Resolve, described as the operation to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and Operation Epic Fury, described as the operation to degrade Iran's nuclear and missile capabilities, per the same source. Bingen stated that China and Russia have developed capabilities targeting U.S. space assets, with, in her characterization, no orbit out of reach from LEO to GEO, from low Earth orbit to geosynchronous orbit. China operates more than 500 intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance satellites per Bingen. She described a Chinese intelligence company as supplying satellite imagery and targeting information to Iran, a form of indirect capability transfer with direct battlefield consequences. On Russia, Bingen made a point worth dwelling on. Russia's first strike in Ukraine was not, in her framing, the ground incursion. It was a cyber attack against commercial communications satellite Viasat, aimed at disrupting Ukrainian battlefield communications. Starlink subsequently served as a communications lifeline for Ukraine, a private commercial network filling a critical military gap. That sequencing, a space-based cyber attack before boots crossed any border, reflects how integrated space operations have become with conventional warfare. General Whiting, per the CSIS transcript, presented an animation showing a Russian satellite that entered a coplanar orbit with a U.S. government satellite, shadowed it, released a projectile that began to move toward the American asset, and which Whiting characterized as a demonstration of a weapon. Bingen added the assessment that Russia is developing a nuclear weapon for orbital deployment that could, in her characterization, indiscriminately wipe out low Earth orbit, affecting satellites belonging to multiple nations, including Russia and China. The implications of that capability extend well beyond any bilateral conflict. On testing history, the last Russian direct ascent anti-satellite missile test occurred in fall 2021. The last Chinese physical demonstration was in 2027. The United States has implemented a unilateral moratorium on testing destructive anti-satellite missiles, a policy choice that, as Bingen noted, has not been matched by either adversary. Bingen described what she characterized as a significant Chinese capability development. Last summer, China demonstrated what was believed to be the first-ever satellite refueling mission at geosynchronous orbit, involving two satellites that came together. The significance of that demonstration lies in its implications for satellite longevity, operational flexibility, and the ability to service or potentially interfere with other satellites at that altitude. Bingen characterized U.S. investment in comparable maneuver and mobility capabilities as lagging. China also has multiple Starlink-equivalent satellite constellations in development, involving thousands of satellites, per Bingen, suggesting China is actively building redundancy into its own space architecture, while simultaneously developing the tools to threaten America's. Tom Carrico argued for space-based interceptors as part of the Golden Dome Initiative and discussed space-based sensors as a critical requirement for tracking hypersonic glide vehicles. His argument, hypersonic glide vehicles fly too low for effective ground-based radar tracking and are unpredictable in their trajectories, meaning ground-based systems have a fundamental geometric limitation. Space Development Agency's proliferated warfighter space architecture was cited as addressing this sensor requirement. Heather Williams noted the 1967 Outer Space Treaty as being, in her words, on its last limbs, and cited concerns about Russian orbital nuclear weapon development as one driver of that assessment. She referenced the 1979 Moon Treaty as prohibiting militarization of the moon, noting the United States did not ratify it. Bingen concluded with a practical diplomatic proposal, establishing communications channels with China regarding potential satellite collisions in low Earth orbit. The current practice, she described, involves sending emails that may go unanswered. As both nations operate increasingly dense constellations, the absence of reliable collision avoidance communication is a risk multiplier that benefits no one. The next section brings us to the architecture that underlies all of this, the global trading system, and whether it still functions as advertised. Chad Bown, Reginald Jones Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and former chief economist at the State Department during the Biden administration, and Sumaya Keynes, economic columnist at the Financial Times and former 8-year contributor to The Economist, appeared on the CSIS Trade Guys podcast to discuss their co-authored 221-page book, How to Win a Trade War, scheduled for publication shortly after Memorial Day. Bound's framing was stark. He stated that the rules-based system he was trained to rely on no longer exists as a practical guide for policymakers. Podcast host Bill Reinsch described the WTO as having run out of steam about 2008 or so. Keynes pushed back, noting that many governments still observe WTO rules, but acknowledged that some of the world's largest trading actors are now acting unilaterally. The honest position from these analysts is somewhere between those two poles. The framework nominally exists, but its enforcement capacity has eroded, and the largest players increasingly operate outside it when it suits their interests. Bone identified China's Made in China 2025 program and its dual circulation strategy as reflecting a deliberate decision to make the rest of the world dependent on Chinese supply chains, while simultaneously reducing China's own dependencies on others. He cited recent Chinese actions involving rare earths, permanent magnets, and Nexperia chips as examples of Beijing's demonstrated willingness to weaponize supply chain leverage. These are not theoretical capabilities. They are tools China has already deployed. Keynes noted that Europe is confronting a related problem, a flood of Chinese imports redirected by U.S. tariffs, with European producers finding it harder to compete both domestically and in third markets. Europe is attempting to address this through the EU Foreign Subsidies Regulation, and through discussions around sourcing diversification rules that would limit reliance on any single country to between 30 and 40% of supply. Whether those measures would survive WTO litigation is unclear, per Bound. Keynes described the entire space as totally in flux. On the U.S. CHIPS Act, Bound argued it focused heavily on building manufacturing capacity without generating sufficient demand-side signals. He cited Intel's difficulty finding customers as an illustration of that imbalance. You can build the fabs, but if downstream demand hasn't been cultivated, the investment sits underutilized. Keynes offered a memorable framing for the broader risk. Adding multiple competing policy objectives to a subsidy program risks undermining the primary goal. Her phrase, "Don't put fish in a fruit salad," captures the danger of policy overloading. And she argued that limited U.S. institutional experience with large-scale industrial subsidy deployment requires, in her words, a huge amount of humility. On tariff policy more broadly, Bones stated that President Trump has articulated at least half a dozen different stated rationales for current tariff policy simultaneously. His argument is that when a single policy tool is simultaneously justified by revenue generation, manufacturing revival, national security, negotiating leverage, trade balance correction, and domestic political signaling, it becomes difficult to evaluate success or failure by any single measure, and the policy's effectiveness for any individual purpose is correspondingly weakened. Pew Research Center polling was cited by Reinsch, trade consistently ranks at or near the bottom of issues Americans identify as priorities, while the economy and healthcare rank near the top. Cain cited academic research finding that the first Trump administration's tariffs produced no measurable effect on manufacturing employment in areas previously affected by import competition from China, but did find an association between those tariffs and increased political support for the president. That disjunction between economic outcome and political outcome is worth noting. The tariffs may be doing political work even when the economic case is unproven. On export controls, Bone reached back to the Toshiba case from the 1980s to make the point that export control regimes require close coordination among partners because profit incentives make unilateral enforcement insufficient. If one country restricts exports and others don't, the gap gets filled. Reince recalled that the primary domestic effect of the resulting U.S. sanctions legislation was the closure of Toshiba Machine Corporation's U.S. operations, meaning the domestic cost landed on a U.S. business rather than on the foreign target. A previously planned CSIS episode on USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, was rescheduled because talks were set to occur on May 28th and 29th, with the guest episode moved to the week of June 1st. The rescheduling itself is a data point. Trade negotiations are moving fast enough that scheduled commentary is being overtaken by events. Finally, we turn to Australia, where a new national defense strategy represents one of the most significant strategic reorientations in the country's recent history. Australia's 2026 National Defense Strategy was presented by Deputy Prime Minister and Defense Minister Richard Miles at the National Press Club and was assessed by Justin Bassey, Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, in a CSIS-hosted discussion with Michael Green of the U.S. Studies Center. Bassey identified three principal takeaways. The first is a posture of self-reliance, explicitly distinguished by Minister Miles from self-sufficiency, independence, or isolationism. The distinction matters. Self-reliance, as defined in the strategy, means strengthening domestic capabilities while maintaining alliance commitments and trusted partnerships. It is not a pivot away from alliances. It is a commitment to being a more capable and less dependent partner within them. The second takeaway is the most historically significant. The strategy names China as Australia's core strategic threat. Bassey characterized this as a clear departure from previous strategies, framing. He also noted the inherent tension this creates. China is simultaneously Australia's largest trading partner and its core strategic adversary. That dual reality, economic interdependence and security competition existing in the same relationship, is one of the defining challenges of the current era for a country in Australia's position. More importantly, Bassey connected this to a broader context of shifting Australian public opinion. Australians have expressed concern about the unpredictability of the current U.S. administration. But support for the Australia-U.S. alliance itself has remained comparatively steady per Bassey, suggesting a distinction in Australian public thinking between confidence in a specific administration and commitment to the alliance as an institution. On defense spending, Bassey explained a methodological shift that matters for how Australia's numbers are interpreted. Under the newly adopted NATO measurement methodology, Australia's defense spending is currently assessed at approximately 2.7 to 2.8% of GDP, with a government-stated target of 3% by 2033. Under the previous Australian measurement model, spending has remained at just over 2% of GDP. To understand why that baseline matters, the 2% target was first set by Prime Minister Gillard in a 2013 defense white paper and committed to again in a 2016 defense white paper under Defense Minister Maurice Payne. Bassey observed that when the 2013 target was set, Russia had not yet annexed Crimea, the Islamic State had not yet emerged as a significant territorial force, and cyber threats were not a significant policy consideration. The strategic landscape has fundamentally changed, and the spending trajectory reflects that belatedly. On AUKUS, the trilateral security partnership between Australia, the United States, and the United Kingdom, Bassey assessed that it benefits from bipartisan political support across changes of government in all three partner nations. He addressed a notable internal Australian debate directly. Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has argued that concerns about the current U.S. administration mean Australia should reconsider the planned transfer of Virginia-class submarines under the AUKUS pathway. Bossi's assessment, stated clearly, is the opposite. AUKUS strengthens rather than reduces Australian sovereignty by providing access to advanced capabilities Australia could not develop alone. Bossi's also described original open-source research conducted by former ASPI analyst Albert Zhang, who identified an information operations campaign attributed to Beijing. The campaign sought to amplify concerns about Japan's nuclear wastewater release in order to strain Japan's relationships with regional partners, including South Korea, specifically at a time when the United States was working to strengthen trilateral U.S.-Japan-South Korea cooperation. Bossi noted that government agencies could not replicate this finding publicly due to diplomatic constraints, a point that underscores the value of independent research institutions operating outside governmental political calculus. Australia's policy shift on China, Bossi explained, began earlier than many accounts suggest, under Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull around 2016, driven in significant part by intelligence community assessments. The early decision-making on 5G network security was a visible expression of conclusions that the intelligence community had reached before most public commentary had caught up. Bossi described ASPI itself as the first Australian think tank established outside the university sector, set up by the Howard government in the late 1990s with bipartisan support. He expressed concern about a government-commissioned Varghese review, initiated in the second half of 2022, which examined six security-focused think tanks that receive significant government funding. Bossi's worry that an emerging competitive grant process could disincentivize analysts from publishing work critical of the government of the day, a concern about institutional independence that applies well beyond Australia. Taken together, the developments in this briefing trace a world in which the frameworks designed to manage great power competition, arms control treaties, trading rules, diplomatic norms, are under simultaneous pressure from multiple directions. Ukraine is demonstrating that asymmetric drone warfare can impose compounding costs on conventional naval assets. U.S.-Iran negotiations are attempting to freeze a conflict whose military logic has already reshaped the Revolutionary Guard's internal power structure. Space, once a domain of scientific cooperation and strategic stability, is being contested in ways that the 1967 Outer Space Treaty was never designed to address. The rules-based trading system is being navigated by all sides through improvisation rather than established procedure, and Australia is formally naming what its intelligence community has known for years, that the strategic competition with China is the organizing reality of the Indo-Pacific. Thank you for listening. That is your geopolitics briefing for today from the Briefing Desk. We will be back tomorrow with the next edition.